Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I'm Deidre Toller. Today, we'll be talking with the authors of Louisiana Creole People, Afro-Ingenuity and Community. We'll be talking with Daryl Barth and Andrew Jolivet, the authors, and they will tell us more about themselves. Hello, how are you doing today?
Yeah, we're good.
Doing well. Daryl, do you want to start? I do want to just mention our other co-author, Rain Prudhomme Cranford, who sends her regrets that she has some family things. She can't join us today, but was really instrumental in this work, and she's a brilliant literary scholar and a scholar of, you know, many different fields, but this book would not be possible without her, so definitely want to make sure we mention our co-editor here.
Yeah, for sure. I was just saying before we went on the air that really this probably wouldn't have happened if it weren't for Rain, to be quite frank. A few years ago, we were all involved together in putting together a journal of Louisiana Creole Studies. And, you know, between that time that we came up with that idea and now, you know, Rain moved up to Calgary, Andrew moved from San Francisco to San Diego, and I moved from Amsterdam to New York. So, I mean, you know, there's been a whole lot of twists and turns. But, you know, if it weren't for Rain saying, you know what, we put all of this effort in, we might as well publish that as a book, it probably wouldn't have occurred to me. So, props definitely go up to our cousin in Calgary.
Yeah, and just for the brief intro, I mean, Rain's an assistant professor of English and International Indigenous Studies at the University of Calgary. Daryl, you're over at what, history at Dartmouth, right? And I'm at the University of California, San Diego, in the Ethnic Studies Department.
Tell the audience how you guys are all connected.
Daryl, I think you should tell this story, and it's how we opened the book.
Well, I'll say this, that anywhere that you have a group of people with transgenerational connections in a specific land base, the way that Louisiana Creole people are, eventually what you find is that, you know, after a few centuries, those people are pretty much all related to one another, whether or not it's by blood or marriage or both. And, you know, Rain, Andrew, and I all met, I don't know, probably at least 10 years ago now, 12 years ago now. It had to be longer, 2008, 2009, sometime around then. But, you know, we met in online forums talking about Louisiana Creole history and Louisiana Creole people. And, you know, any Creole person who's listening to this right now will recognize the familiarity of this story. It doesn't take long for Creole people to be in one room together before they start asking each other, you know, well, what was your mama's name? And who are your people? Who's your people? And, you know, every Creole person has the same sort of response. They'll start rattling off family names until eventually you hit a point where people go, oh, okay, so yeah, I'm related to them. So that Andrew and I are related. We are cousins. We are both descendants of the Guidrys. Rain and I are related. We are both descendants of Matuias from Cane River. And Andrew and Rain are related. These sorts of relationships, you know, we refer to one another as cousins. You know, in Ishak, the word, the familiar word is Shuki. You know, we are all related to one another. And Creole people in Louisiana are different in the way that they interpret words like cousins from people in other parts of the country, insofar as, you know, we recognize like fifth and sixth cousins as family from where we're from. And, you know, that's a thing that's actually, that's an indigenous thing that Indians do, Amerindian people do that. And that is a cultural inheritance that we have from that experience of people who are descendants of settlers who indigenized themselves, who intermarried with the people of the land and became part of it. And there's a difference between that sort of process and the process of colonial domination that's, to be quite frank, the sort of bedrock of Americanization and Anglo-American colonial culture on Turtle Island. You know, our ancestors didn't come in and proceed to genocide indigenous people so much as they came in and began to intermarry with them. And, you know, from enslaved Africans to enslaved Amerindian people to working class French and German and Spanish and Maltese and Filipinos, who all ended up occupying the same spaces over time in Louisiana in these Latin cultural contexts, produced us and produced a people who can point to a process of ethnogenesis that begins at the beginning of the 18th century, the end of the 17th century, and that is complete by the time that the United States colonizes the Louisiana Territory after 1803. And this book is our attempt to contextualize what that process looks like once you drag it out of that sort of historical yesteryear stuff that most people associate with conversations about Creolite, you know, like, oh, Creole, Louisiana, that was a thing from the 1700s and the 1800s. You know, the Civil War made us all, you know, Americans. Well, you know, certainly that is one view of the story of Creole people in Louisiana. But, you know, when you look at primary source accounts of Creole people from the first half of the 20th century, you recognize that that's not true. And that Creole people in Louisiana, in particular New Orleans, where I'm from, had a very strong Creole identity that was intimately connected to a linguistic heritage that was forcibly suppressed through processes of Americanization that include English language only education and the imposition of Anglo-American racial paradigms, that is the sort of stark contrast between black people and white people, that never really existed under Latin regimes in Louisiana because it just couldn't. Now that's my perspective, and I offer perspective of the historian. I think what's good about this book in particular is that the three editors of the book represent three very distinct sort of vantages of scholarly discourse. I'm a historian, But Andrew is a sociologist and a cultural theorist. And what that means is that his view on these processes is going to be different from mine. If anything, Andrew provides, I think, the sort of theoretical frameworks that I use for my historical analysis. Whereas Rain, as a literary theorist, I think, you know, first of all, the notion of the dialogue between scholarly and academic sources and community sources was all Rain's idea. And that's, well, not all Rain's idea, it was Andrew's idea too. But, you know, Rain's notion that, what Rain brings to the table is the notion that these cultural expressions are not historical artifacts. These cultural expressions are living and breathing and everyday contemporary articles of cultural production. You know, we didn't go anywhere. We still exist. And we're still creating Creole art and we're still creating Creole ideas. And this is all despite the fact that we were colonized by Americans that would prefer that we not exist as indigenous people, that prefer that we did not exist as Creole people, because integral to that process of Americanization is a historical paradigm of white Anglo domination.
If, yeah, no, I don't, and please, Deirdre, if you have questions and things you want to have us tackle, I agree with everything Daryl's saying, and I wanted to just take a step back a little bit. For listeners who don't have the book yet, or what's the book about, right, or how is it framed, just, you know, just the title, I would start there, and I think Daryl's sharing the story of, you know, when I first started doing research, you know, for my doctoral dissertation, it was on Louisiana Creoles. One thing I always knew, right? So, as growing up Creole, my father's Creole, my mom's African-American mix. And one thing I always knew is that people have this, a couple things, right? The first thing they'll tell you, if you say you're Creole, is they imagine French-speaking black folks, right? So it's a very simplistic kind of view, or bourgeoisie, or passing, all these kind of racial kind of tropes that are, you know, kind of old. There's some truth to some things, but they're also a little bit old. But I think to build on what Daryl was saying, the book is about a response, I think, and to two works that were done before, Sybil Kine's book, which was an anthology called Creole Legacy, I think it was Creole Legacy. And so Kine's book was an interesting one, but it didn't really engage back with the community. We're also, I think, building off of a Native American Studies book, Reasoning Together, where there were community responses. But the title, Peoplehood, this is what Daryl's referring to. So when we think about like French and Spanish being there, or the historical context, all throughout that period, but to this very moment and day, when people do what we did and figure out how we're related. In fact, I'm closer, as Daryl was mentioning, to some of my probably fourth, fifth, we don't even say that, right? I mean, they're just cousins. And you know, if they're older than you, they're your aunt or your uncle. They're not even your cousin anymore, right? But peoplehood is what ties this whole book together. Some might say sovereignty or self-determination. A peoplehood is how do we see, or a peoplehood matrix is what we talk about in the book, is we want to blow up that idea of Creoles as these black, white people are living in this binary. So that's where the Afro-indigeneity, right? People of African descent are indigenous in a different context, not in the Americas. People of American Indian, you know, backgrounds are also indigenous. We want to talk about the full complexity of the Creole experience, and not just in a historic context, but we also want to talk about it in that contemporary context. And the book is divided into, you know, four sections to really speak to that. And in each section, there's a chapter written by an academic, followed by one or two community responses to what's been written. The first section is Sacred Histories from Kinship to Cultural Resurgences. The second section is Landscapes from Homelands to Food and Health. Such an important thing that, you know, as someone who's done a lot of work in around critical mixed race studies too, for people who'd come from like multi-generational mixed backgrounds, like pretty much most Latino people, like Creole people, like most American Indian people, even at this point, you know, it's really, I think, important that we not just talk about, oh, we want to assert our identity, or, you know, it's not just about identity anymore, politics. It's how that identity impacts how we engage with land, nature, food, other people, culture. The third section is on languages, which is so important in terms of preserving, continuing to the language. So it's languages, literacy, and bodies. And there's some great stuff in here where I've never seen much written about body image, body shape, the health issues specific in, you know, Creole and other Black Indian or Afro-Indigenous communities, LGBT queer studies. And then the final section, bringing it home really to that idea of peoplehood, is the last section, is called Ceremonials and Cultural Practice. And it really looks at some of the activist work, what people have done, and their testimonials from our community members, from our elders, who we acknowledge and thank for continuing the culture and not letting it die. Because there was a book written many years ago, right, The Forgotten People. And Creoles, you know, kind of took issue with that, right, that we are not a forgotten people. And I think this book is a response in some ways to a new generation of, you know, Creole people who are refusing binary representations of who they are, for a sort of more complex, nuanced, you know, really engagement with all of their varied, our varied experiences.
Now, how is this book similar or different from the popular book Reasoning Together?
I think that the engagement with, Blackness and is central here. I would also say, in terms of some of the discussion around specific problems or issues like health, that are discussed in a little bit more detail. I do think you have similar things around sort of this notion of peoplehood or critical thinking, right? It's about asserting an intellectual tradition in Native communities, but one that is rooted not just in sort of academic trajectories, but also those from community. I think that's what we kind of have in common with that book, is that both are kind of doing this work of making sure that this is from the community, right? That it's coming from that place. I think, again, though, what is different is really definitely this focus on looking at how has Afro-Indigeneity itself as a category, both historically and in the present, and culturally, linguistically, and otherwise, how has that impacted Louisiana Creole people and their and our work to be recognized as a people, right? So that's what I would say.
Tell us more about those communities. You talk about Cane River. You talk about Lake Charles. Tell us about what you found in the various communities.
Well, as Daryl, I think, was mentioning a little bit about, you know, New Orleans and some other places, I think what's powerful is that we have to remember, and this was something I talked about in a book I wrote many, many years ago on Louisiana Creoles, from that dissertation that I referred to, focused on Native American identity, Louisiana Creoles, mixed race identity and cultural recovery. Because what I was interested in is where are the cultural places where Native identity shows up in Creole communities, or where do those practices, traditions show up? But I would say the reason I'm bringing it up is because the Louisiana Creole Heritage Center in Natchitoches at that time, back then, this is the early 2000, actually late 90s, 97, 98 through 2000 or two or so, they identified, I think, 30, 40, what they called Creole colonies or villages, they called them, all very unique and different. I think that, like architecture, for example, if you think about New Orleans, we will immediately notice the architectural structures, the French and Spanish influences there, as well as African influence in some ways as well, I would say. And then when you look to places in the Southwest, like Opelousas, where my family's from, or Bayou Mallette, or you go a little bit north, right, up into Cane River and Natchitoches, these communities, I think what they have in common was often religion, not all, you know, but religion does play a key role in that. But I think it's this sense of peoplehood is what connects every one of those Creole communities and villages. It's meeting after Sunday and, you know, going and hanging out with your cousins or, you know, going to your mama's house or your nanan's house. Those are the kind of common threads, right? And so I think those connections to land, but what I also want to say is what we also recognize is that it's not just those communities in Louisiana, it's a diaspora, right? We know historically how many Creoles actually left Louisiana because of Americanization that was coming, right? That Daryl talked about earlier. So many went. We've heard a bit about Haitian and Dominican folks coming into New Orleans, but we also are into Louisiana, but not so much about Creoles leaving and going into places like Southern Mexico, Veracruz, Tampico, and right. And, but also that Creoles are all over now. What's that?
And going back to Haiti.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, and they're all over now, right? Where Daryl's at in New York, you know, has been a place, not Chicago has been huge where Creoles are relocated. Certainly California is another place. So we are, the Creole people are everywhere. And people, what I've noticed and learned over time, and I think the book talks about too, to a certain extent, people carry that with them. They carry those stories. They carry that memory. I love that Daryl started with how we talk about the cousin thing, and it doesn't matter how far, because I can go to some state, never have met this person. They're, you know, who knows, maybe a fifth, sixth cousin. You would think it was my sibling or something, and I haven't seen them in forever, and they're cooking, or that people carry with them this cultural ethic, if you will, or sense of community that is undying. It's undying.
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, part of that connectivity that Andrew's talking about historically is the result of, you know, 150 years worth of endogamous marriage, you know, culturally endogamous, you know, where Creole people only really married other Creole people. And sometimes you just had to leave your community to go somewhere else to find, you know, someone to marry from another community. So what you end up with is, for example, you know, New Orleans is this sort of urban center, right? But people from New Orleans would go and marry people from Bayou Teche, would marry people from New Iberia, would marry people from Natchitoches, and vice versa. You know, you would have people from all of these communities in northern Louisiana, southwest Louisiana, would meet people from New Orleans and then would leave the city to go out and live on the bayou or the prairie. So that what you ended up with was a consistent cultural expression, regardless of where you were. You know, there's this sort of Creole triangle that's the Teche, New Orleans, in Louisiana, anyway, that's the Teche, New Orleans, and Natchitoches, where you have people who are participating concurrently in this process of cultural production that goes, you know, on for, well, that's still going on right now. You know, one really good essay in that book is about the production of filé. And it doesn't matter where you go in Louisiana, everybody knows what filé is. Now, not everybody necessarily cooks with it, but everybody understands what it is, and everybody recognizes that it is an integral part of the culinary culture that we all practice. And that sort of commonality, I think, enables people who have never met one another, but who recognizes those sort of cultural markers. Because, you know, recognizing those cultural markers, what it means is, wait a minute, this person isn't a stranger. In fact, I bet if I probe long enough, I can figure out not only that we are related, but how we are related too. And that makes interactions between Creole people just different.
Now, tell us the difference between Creole and Cajun.
Cajuns are Creole Acadians.
I like that. Should we? You want to give a little more background? More background? Why we're probably laughing? I mean, I think you're. I mean, absolutely.
Fight over this, man.
What's that?
People fight over this.
No, absolutely. No, I hear you. It's interesting. I mean, I'll just jump in here, and Daryl, you know, definitely jump back in. I mean, a really good friend, colleague of ours, Christoph Landry, has written and talked a lot about this. And I think the reason, let's see, you said they're Acadian Creoles or Cajun Creoles. How did you put it, Daryl?
Creole Acadians.
Creole Acadians. So I think what it is, you know, Christoph's work really speaks to this very well. And he talks about how, particularly during the 1970s, some say even earlier, a little bit earlier, but especially in the 70s and the 80s, at the sort of this height, there was a Cajunization process in Louisiana where everything was made Cajun and popular and commercialized, so that when people think about Louisiana, they're like, oh, I love them that Cajun food and dirty rice. Like, we don't call it dirty rice, we call it rice dressing, okay? Like, that became this sort of thing. But the Acadians, right, who left or were expelled, came from Nova Scotia, that's part of their story, were exiled here. Christoph and others, we also would agree with that. They blended into an already existing culture. They intermarried with Creoles. Most of us, like Daryl said, we both are Guidries or Guidry, as my dad says. They're originally Cajun, right? Or Acadian, Acadian, right? That's how they got to Cajun from the accent, Acadian, right? So, you know, they are our cousins. However, historically, it was a fighting thing because Cajuns were mostly in rural areas. They were seen, quite simply put, my dad used to say, because people would say, you're a Cajun, you're from Louisiana. He's like, I won't cuss on the radio, but he cussed. And he told them, I ain't no effing Cajun. And he said, Cajuns is white folks and Creoles is black folks. And that was the generational way in which they lived. I mean, that was the context of how they talked about it, not knowing that many of the very Cajun people he was talking about were also our relatives, right? They were intermarried, ate similar foods, particularly in the rural places and Southwest places. So it's a fight because I think Creoles were all, you know, the quote unquote, you know, more, you know, educated, things like that. So to be called a Cajun in some ways to Creoles, I think was a bit of an insult. I think that's evolving and changing now. But it's funny because Americanization it continued to do its work after the purchase and, you know, at Reconstruction into that 1970s, 1980s period where people think Louisiana and they're thinking about Cajuns and not really sure, you know, what that really is, right? What are our popular cultural references to Creoles? Beyonce, people don't even really, you know, fully understand, I think, still what Creole people are. These are kind of contested categories. But anyway, that was a long way to make sure to really give why it's a hot topic, I think, sometimes, and what I think we and folks like Christoph have done a good job to really talk about. You know, the Cajuns are of Creole culture, right? We all share Creole culture.
Let me say this, that every significant artifact of Cajun cultural identity is a part of a cultural context that is inseparable from Creole Louisiana. You know, there's Cajun gumbo and all that sort. They don't make gumbo in Nova Scotia. All right. Gumbo is an African word. And that cultural practice that has been identified with Cajun people is ultimately a product of Creolization. At one point, because the identity of Louisiana Creole became associated with people of color, white Creoles in Louisiana en masse between roughly the 1880s and the 1930s or so, just vacated the Creole identity. They no longer referred to themselves as Creole. Then they became French, or then they became Franco-American, or they became Acadian, which played into this sort of notion of whiteness insofar as you say Canada and people think about white people. Where in the same way that you say Creole Louisiana and people imagine black people. But, you know, like Andrew just said, Andrew's a Guidry, I'm a Guidry. The Guidrys arrived in Louisiana from Acadia as a result of the Grand Arrangement. You know, my grandparents were Terriers. It's another family that ended up in Louisiana as a result of a Grand Derangement. But if I were to walk, you know, down the street of, you know, in St. Martin, declaring myself Cajun, you know, people would look at me askew, you know, precisely because at this point, these terms have been sort of have been used as substitutes for racialized terms, for black and white identities that, you know, that America demands be separate, but within the context of Latin Louisiana, we're never really separate. You know, white people practice Creole culture, black people practice Creole culture, indigenous people practice Creole culture, and the descendants of all three of those groups, of which there were many, also practice Creole culture. So, I mean, the question of what's the difference between Cajuns and Creoles, I think is a question that's predicated on a dichotomy that doesn't really exist outside of people's racial politics.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, tell us about Jim Crow, the anti-blackness and the anti-Indian racism in Louisiana, and how this was an attempt to really destroy the communities.
Well, Jim Crow is an extension of a larger process of colonial violence, isn't it? The imposition of white supremacy happens as soon as Europeans set foot on native soil. Jim Crow was just a reiteration of that same colonial agenda, updated for a post-civil rights amendment reality that happens after the Civil War. Creating a group of people, that is, colored people, who could be legally discriminated against, served the interests of white oligarchs just as much as categorical disenfranchisement of anyone who wasn't white served their interests prior to the Civil War. So, I mean, it's just all colonial. It's just all colonial racism and garbage.
And I just to piggyback and add on to it, I mean, I think that continuing kind of colonial legacy, right, is about has always been about a displacement, a dispossession of indigenous people, about a virulent sort of violence against black and native women's bodies, right? And we know in Louisiana, Creole women were central, as were actually many, you know, African and American Indian women, you know, who maybe were not, you know, earlier on, who were the sort of matriarchs of various families, that they held these things together. But that anti-blackness, that anti-indigeneity can be seen because something that I talk about it as a bloodless genocide or a paper genocide, that we don't just erase Native people, you know, but through murder, right? We, you know, right, or through the physical forms of genocide. But what about cultural genocide? And so when I think, you know, right, we think about Louisiana Creole people, the fact that people don't haven't historically thought of our communities as indigenous communities, our peoplehood, or our right to exist as a unique group is very much right about an Americanization process that Jim Crow, you know, continues, right? We see it now, right? There was just a senator last week who tweeted after Roe v. Wade was overturned. He tweets, Plessy next, you know, let's do Plessy and Brown versus Board of Education next. Excuse me? Right? And so I think that speaks to this way, and not even realizing, right, a Creole man, right, Plessy, who stood up, right, and helped to lead work around desegregation, but, you know, and some of these, you know, Jim Crowisms that still live with us. But I think that in Louisiana, just to give a specific context, there was an act called Act 220, and when it was passed, it basically, this statute changed the racialization or the racial category of American Indians who were counted as colored, basically, among Creoles and free Black folk and Asian groups that were in Louisiana. And then you had a white category. Well, they clouded, right, and wanted to separate because they were trying to turn Indians into Black only people, right? So as Americanization happens, right, I think that was the other impact of Jim Crow, is you see people leaving, maybe you see more encroachment of Americanization. I can recall speaking to older Creoles, you know, at one point, recalling their grandparents and saying, oh, you guys have to change now. You can't be Creole anymore. Like that racially, right? Or in school, what kind of language, you know, Daryl was speaking about this earlier, what, you know, language you could speak. Languages, Ngugi wa Thiong'o says, right, in Decolonizing the Mind, language is a carrier of culture, right? And so in some ways we can reinvent, I think, through English, but does it carry the culture in the same way? So I think for a lot of Creole folk, maybe we could still continue to be Creole culturally. I think there becomes a racialization process, which is about denigrating Black folk and erasing Indian folk. And that is the sad history, not just of Louisiana, but of, you know, the United States and many other, you know, settler or, you know, states.
Now tell us about Mrs. Janet Colson and the Creole Heritage Center. You have a little chapter about her in your book.
Yeah. Jana was like a mom, was a mom to me. You know, when I first started doing research back in the 90s and found out there was a Creole Heritage Center, I was like, whoa, wow, this is cool. I remember showing up, my cousins in Raywood, Texas, and Fontenose, who that's how Rain and I are connected, Fontenose and Prudhomme's. Some cousins drove me up to Natchitoches from Raywood, Texas, which is on that border to Lake Charles. And I remember meeting Janet, and she was this amazing, dedicated elder who's now an ancestor who kept the culture going in many ways. So she, you know, helped create, she had a vision. Right. She says, I always quote her. She said, my daddy thought Louisiana was heaven. And she carried that drive and that passion. So she organized international conferences that brought people who may identify as Creole from the Caribbean or other parts of the world together. She organized cultural events and really brought a lot of visibility to the continuance of our people. There's been other folks, I think Daryl knows better, Gilbert Martin, who we also recognize, who did this kind of work, Terrell Delphin, who did this kind of work. And it's interesting that they're all, the people are spread out in different areas. A lot of them, like Janet and Terrell, were in Cane River and Natchitoches. Others were in like the Southwest or in New Orleans. And so she's one of what I would describe a culture bearer, a culture keeper, a medicine person, really, because what she did allows our people to continue. And so this book is in many ways a continuance of her amazing work, of her legacy, and that of all of our ancestors, you know, our parents and our grandparents and great grandparents.
You know, I think that after the 1960s, the sort of Black is Beautiful movement, I think a lot of Creole people in Louisiana were forced to make what I think is sort of a false choice between choosing to be black or choosing to be Creole. And certainly in New Orleans, the notion was certainly, when I was growing up in the 1970s and 1980s, that claiming Creole identity was often seen as controversial and divisive, especially by African Americans. In fact, it was a few years ago that Beyonce did some song where she referred to, you know, her African American mama or her Creole dad or something like that. And there was a woman from African American woman from New Orleans who wrote an essay in response to it, who claimed to be deeply triggered by Creole people declaring themselves Creole people because she interpreted that based on her experience in New Orleans as Creole people just not wanting to be associated with black people. And so there's this sort of, you know, pressure on Creole people, which, you know, itself is also a manifestation of Americanization, because it's African Americans who are advancing these arguments. There's this pressure to abandon Creole identity and Creole self-identification. And so really, you know, it's not until the sort of 90s that you sort of get this Creole revival happening, in which Colson was sort of an integral part of that Creole Heritage Festival. And, you know, it happens in places like Natchitoches. It happens in places like Lafayette. It doesn't happen in New Orleans initially because New Orleans is like this sort of epicenter of that pressure of Americanization. You know, it's an urban environment. It's the place in Louisiana that's the most thoroughly integrated into the larger sort of American economy. So for me, you know, I left New Orleans in 1994 to go all over the world. You know, I was in Spain for a while. I was in England for a while. I was in San Francisco for a while. But when I came back to Louisiana in 2002, I guess it was, all of a sudden, you know, it's like there's this Creole Heritage Heritage Center in Natchitoches. There's a Louisiana Creole academic conference happening in October in New Orleans. Like this massive cultural resurgence and revival. And, you know, for me as a Creole person who had, you know, been everywhere and back and then ended up in New Orleans, the entire discourse and the entire dialogue about Creole identity had just completely changed in 10 years. And, you know, to be frank, like that's actually when it was in that aftermath that I actually read Andrew's book for the first time, which, you know, it changed the entire way that I perceived myself in relation to the rest of the world. Because, you know, I think, and I'm talking now about Andrew's book, Louisiana Creole and Native American Mixed Race Identity. Now, you know, Andrew was the first person who I'd ever read who said, you know, look, this whole black-white binary thing that has been imposed on us is just fake. It's artificial. It's not real. And it doesn't speak to the way that we perceive reality or the way that we experience our lives. And so, you know, anyone who says that it's impossible to be black and to be native and to be, you know, French, to be Creole, to be American all at the same time is lying to you. And that changed my life. It was after reading that book that I was able to perceive a vantage from which to articulate the argument that I made in my dissertation, which ended up being my own book, Creole, the book that I just published last year on Creole New Orleans. So, you know, that's who the Colsons were to me. They were a part of a cultural renaissance and a movement that is certainly articulated in this book that represents Creole people demanding to be considered as a people on their own terms rather than being interpreted through the eyes of others, in particular others who have never been culturally sympathetic to us.
Now, what is the message? You have anything else to say, Andrew?
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, I think Daryl hit it on the head, just that there's a kind of cultural kind of tourism that happens. And I think, as Daryl was, just New Orleans, when I think about why that was. But I wanted to say that, you know, people, it's like any mini groups, just like other American Indian communities. We want to see the folks at the powwow. We want to see the performative. So we want to see, I was going to say, music played a huge part, I think, in the interest, right, in the 80s, Queen Ida, who was touring, you know, for example, or Buzu Chavis, these folks who were touring all over the world, in Europe, all over the U.S., brought some attention. But that's also simultaneously when this stuff was being branded as Cajun, and so it would be palatable in a particular way. And so I think it's been interesting because folks like Janet and that renaissance that Daryl's talking about, I think, push back on the ways in which people were trying to define, you know, define who we are. So I just kind of wanted to throw that in, that I think Zydeco played an interesting role too in the visibility of Louisiana, but then also, ironically, even though they were listening to Zydeco, not necessarily Cajun, it was a combination. It was yet another formation of a mixture, right, of Creole sounds with, and I don't know if I'd even say there actually were Cajun sounds. People say that was Cajun. It was really French, and fiddle music was the influence, and the rest is all Creole, you know. So, but anyway, I think that was also important to just add.
Well, what is the overall message you would like for your audience to leave with once they finish your book? What is the message?
I would say, go ahead, Daryl.
Pick up the baton. We're doing our part for our era. You know, like Andrew said early on, you know, Sybil Kine published her book on Creole people more than 20 years ago now. And you know, for its time, it was a valiant and very valuable and very sorely needed effort. But that effort also needed to be updated. There are discourses that exist today that just simply did not exist when Sybil Kine published her work. And, you know, me and Andrew and Rain, all very purposefully and all very thoughtfully picked up this project as a conscious effort to continue this discourse for whoever the next generation of Creole scholars is going to be. You know, we're doing our part. We're leaving our bit for posterity.
Absolutely. And then I would just add, I want to read just briefly from our conclusion. The chapters in this volume are a beginning, not an ending. We hope that other scholars, both Louisiana Creoles and other Afro-Indigenous communities, will join in conversations about recognition and resistance within Afro-Indigenous and Latinx people across the Americas. It is our hope and intention that this book will inspire more conversations about the everyday realities of race, gender, class, and equity among people of mixed Afro-Indigenous descent in the Americas. There's an old French expression, les haricots no sont pas salés. When translated, it means the snap beans aren't salty, or basically they just aren't ready, or the food isn't done. And so as we end, we say the work isn't done. The snap beans, the stories, the conversations, and the interventions into the field are still not seasoned or salty enough. May the work continue in a good way. And I think that's what we want. We want people to have critical conversations about something that's impacting other communities across the Americas. And that's the question of, you know, blackness and indigeneity and people who are both and not either or, right? So as people moved and start using terms like BIPOC instead of POC, let's say who we mean. Let's be specific. And in this case, we're trying to be specific about telling the story of our people. And as Daryl said, may that good work continue. And I hope the next generation. I'm really happy, right? Because what I can say is when I started this, like doing this like 25, I don't know, years ago, and I felt lonely, very lonely. Now there's Creole Facebook groups with 30,000, 40,000 people on it. that a younger and a new generation is keeping the culture going. And we have Janet and Gilbert and Terrell and, you know, folks like that to really thank for that work.
I have taken up enough of your time. What is the next project you're going to be working on?
Oh, no. I don't know. I'm working on an article right now for a Louisiana Creole Journal. And, I'll be honest that right now there's so many just shocking and horrible things happening in the United States that, you know, the idea of projecting myself into the future is not an easy proposition one way or the other. But, you know, I'm interested in the history of American labor. I'm interested in the history of Afro-Indigenous people. I am interested in the history of struggle against colonial violence in the Western Hemisphere. And, you know, the parts that I know the best are the parts that I imagine I'll focus on, because I believe that scholars are at their best when they're writing about what they know about.
Yeah, and for me, I actually am finally doing something I've been wanting to do for a long time. It is finished. We're doing some editing. I'm actually working with Rain actually on this because it's a press that she and another cousin of ours, Carolyn Dunn, they run a press called That Painted Horse Press. Mostly publishing poets and other creative writers. So I have a poetry cookbook coming out later this year called Gumbo Circuitry, Poetic Routes, Gastronomic Legacies. So if you want to taste some of the things we've been talking about too, that food, that fusion of African, Latin, Indigenous cuisine, it's definitely in there, along with some poetry about the land and Louisiana. And then I have another book that I've been working on forever, so I don't know. Hopefully it'll get done this year. It's called Thriving Circuitry, Queer Afro-Indigenous Futurity and Kinship. And that's contracted with University of Washington Press. Yeah.
Well, we'll be looking forward to all of your interesting projects. And thank you again for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having me.